Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Imagine for a second that you're trying to build this fiercely loyal, globally recognized media empire completely from the ground up.
Right, which is not easy to do.
No, not at all. And if you hired like a team of high-priced PR consultants, they'd hand you a very predictable playbook.
Oh, absolutely. They'd tell you to meticulously curate your public image.
Exactly. They'd say, script your content to target a very specific demographic. And they would absolutely demand that you never, ever openly insult your most dedicated fans.
Yeah, that's just the standard corporate blueprint. I mean, everything has to be sanitized, categorized, and above all, perfectly controlled, so you don't accidentally, you know, alienate a single potential consumer.
Right. So how on earth does a 52-year-old administrative worker manage to build a dedicated digital community by doing, well, the exact opposite of that?
It's a great question.
I mean, how does someone cultivate an audience by falling asleep during the biggest global television event of the year, broadcasting explicitly taboo details from his basement, and fiercely demanding that his listeners perform moral penance for his own technological mistakes?
It honestly sounds like a recipe for absolute career sabotage.
Totally.
But, you know, in the wild, largely unmapped frontier of early independent digital media, those exact behaviors didn't alienate an audience, they actually galvanized one.
Well, welcome to Ruination, the early years. I'm your host, King.
And I am your expert guide to the archives, Gail.
For you, the listener, our mission today is to really take a magnifying glass to the massive archival source material of the big, fatty online universe.
Or the BFO, as it's affectionately known.
Right, the BFO. And we're going to serve as your shortcut to becoming entirely well-informed on a very specific, pivotal week in the life and the stories of the show's creator, Big Fatty.
We are zeroing in on the events surrounding mid-August 2008.
And we didn't just, like, pull this specific week out of a hat, right?
No, not at all. The middle of August 2008 operates as a near-perfect microcosm of the entire BFO ecosystem.
It really does.
When you look at the source material from this week, you see the strange, almost paradoxical alchemy of this show at work. You know, you see how mundane daily annoyances, massive pop culture events, and this wildly eccentric cast of listener characters all just kind of collide.
But before we get to the specific events of August 2008, we really need to establish the architectural foundation of this universe.
Crucial context, for sure.
Because if you don't understand the physical and psychological space Big Fatty operates in, the chaos of this week just won't make any sense to you.
Right.
And that foundation is built on a stark, almost brutal dichotomy between two worlds, which he calls the coal mine and the fat cave.
Yeah, Big Fatty, who, by the way, also refers to himself quite frequently as the fat one. He lives a life deeply divided.
Very divided.
The coal mine is his vernacular for his day job. This is a corporate administrative role that he has been tethered to for nearly 40 years.
40 years? I mean, when you just sit with that number for a second, the psychological weight of it is staggering.
It's massive.
That is four decades of waking up to an alarm, putting on a professional mask, dealing with corporate bureaucracy, and adhering to strict, sanitized social norms. The coal mine represents the absolute pinnacle of oppressive, structured adult responsibility.
It is the ultimate restriction.
Yeah.
And, you know, the natural psychological reaction to 40 years of restriction is to build an escape hatch.
Naturally.
And that escape hatch is his home studio, which he calls the Fat Cave. It's this dedicated space nestled inside his residence, a property he actually later dubs the villa in Fat Acres.
I love that. And the moment he crosses the threshold into the Fat Cave, the corporate suit comes off, the proverbial camisole goes on, and all the filters are completely stripped away.
It's his absolute sanctuary.
It is. But here is the paradox that I find so fascinating. He creates this alt-tight sanctuary for free expression and escape from the rigidity of his day job, but then he imposes an incredibly strict structural rule on his own podcast.
You're talking about the daily time limit.
Yes. Monday through Friday, without fail, he produces a show, but almost every single episode is capped at exactly 20 minutes.
20 minutes on the dot.
And like, I have to question this approach. We usually think of creative freedom as having no boundaries. If you tell an independent storyteller they only have 20 minutes to speak, they might feel incredibly stifled.
Oh, absolutely.
So why would someone fleeing the strict rules of the corporate world immediately build a tiny, unyielding box for their art? Doesn't that just recreate the restriction?
On the surface, yeah, it seems totally contradictory. But you have to look at the mechanics of what a 20-minute limit actually does to a narrative.
Okay, what does it do?
Well, if he had 2 or 3 hours a day to just ramble into a microphone, the show would entirely lose its velocity. The mundane details of his life. A broken light bulb in his refrigerator, frustrating drive home in traffic, a tedious trip to the Sam's Club, they would just evaporate into the ether.
Right, they wouldn't hold any weight.
Exactly. But because he only has 20 minutes, he is forced to aggressively distill his day.
I see. So it acts like a pressure cooker.
Precisely. The unyielding format forces the chaotic, mundane details of his personal existence to become highly potent and concentrated. He has to take the sprawling mess of an adult life and compress it into this highly consumable, predictable daily capsule.
And for the listener, that builds immense trust.
Huge trust. You know exactly what you're getting time-wise. You can fit it perfectly into a commute or like a chore around the house.
Right.
But while the container is incredibly predictable, the actual contents of those 20 minutes are wildly volatile. You have absolutely no idea what bizarre, tangent, or explicit story is going to fill that time.
So the rigid structure is what actually enables the chaos to thrive. It keeps it from just washing over the audience.
Exactly.
And that brings us to the monumental milestone that kicks off our week in question in this deep dive into the source material. We're looking at Monday, August 11th, 2008.
A very big day.
In the archives, this is episode 137 of the BFO, and Big Fatty is celebrating his 52nd birthday.
And in the BFO universe, a birthday is not just some casual mention at the top of a show. It is a massive logistical event that completely overtakes the programming.
Oh, it hijacks everything.
The source material from episode 137 reveals that Big Fatty is completely inundated by an overwhelming deluge of what he calls voice letters.
Right, which was his term for the voicemails his listeners left on a dedicated hotline. You can actually hear the sheer panic mixed with delight in his voice right as the episode opens.
Oh, yeah, he's flustered.
He hits the microphone and immediately exclaims, "Oh, Lord, y'all, how are you? It is the fat one." And y'all, I'm just going to tell you right now, the voice letter box is just overflowing with the love.
And the backlog is so massive that the 20-minute format is immediately threatened.
Instantly.
He has to manage audience expectations right away, announcing that there is absolutely no way he can fit all of these birthday messages into a single episode. He actually warns the audience that it's going to take several days to process and play them all.
Which is incredible when you think about it. The audience essentially hijacked the production schedule for the entire week.
And this right here is the true beating engine of early digital media that we really need to unpack. When you look at traditional radio or television in 2008, the dynamic was strictly one way.
A broadcaster spoke and a passive audience listened.
Exactly. But Big Fatty doesn't just broadcast to his listeners. He actively relies on them to become the co-producers of the content itself.
Because without those voice letters, he just has an empty 20 minutes to fill.
That's it. The community's response dictates the literal structure of the week's programming. He provides the occasion, his 52nd birthday, but the listeners supply the actual raw material. He spends the next several episodes not delivering monologues, but actively reacting to, laughing at, and occasionally being horrified by the audio generated by his own community.
The traditional boundary between the creator and the consumer is just completely obliterated.
The audience is the show.
But before he can even begin to scale that massive mountain of birthday voicemails, he has to address the outside world.
Right, because stuff is happening outside the Fat Cave.
Because the weekend leading up to his birthday featured the biggest global event of the year, and he has to filter it through the very specific, very unique lens of the Fat Cave. The date is Friday, August 8th, 2008.
Ah, yes.
The Beijing Olympics opening ceremonies are broadcasting to billions of people across the globe.
And contextually, we have to remember the cultural impact of that specific opening ceremony.
It was huge.
The 2008 Beijing event is still widely considered one of the most spectacular, meticulously choreographed television events in human history. The sheer scale and the precision were just unprecedented.
And Big Fatty is authentically in awe of it. He takes to the microphone on Monday to recount his viewing experience, and he is just marveling at the statistics.
He really is.
He mentions the 19,000 performers who supposedly never repeated a single part of the massive routine. He's captivated by the thousands of drummers playing these massive sequences in absolute, flawless, perfect unison.
He describes the visuals with genuine wonder. He talks about the performers in light-up costumes, and he's particularly amazed by the massive flat television screens that acted as human canvases.
Oh yeah, where performers were walking and drawing on them.
Right, flying through the air on wires. Despite any political reservations he might have had about China at the time, he readily admits they put on, quote, a hell of a show.
But then, right as he's painting this picture of global majesty, the biological reality of the fat one steps in and provides the quintessential BFO twist.
Of course it does.
He's watching this multi-billion dollar historic broadcast, and he completely misses the climax.
And he confesses it without an ounce of shame.
He literally admits to you, his listener, that he fell into a coma, which is his term for just falling dead asleep, before the Olympic torch was even lit.
He's the whole thing.
He explicitly states that he watched the United States team walk into the stadium, and then his body just completely shut down.
He had to piece together the actual lighting of the torch the next morning by watching news clips.
Yeah, vaguely describing it on the podcast as some kind of angel thing that flew up into the air.
The human biological need for a nap completely overrides a once-in-a-lifetime cultural touchstone.
Wait, I have to stop you there and really interrogate this. We're talking about a guy trying to build a compelling daily show, and he tunes in to the biggest broadcast of the year and just goes to sleep.
Yep.
How on earth does a half-asleep, fundamentally incomplete review of an event actually retain listeners? Wouldn't his audience just turn off the podcast and go watch ESPN or read a professional news recap to find out what actually happened?
You'd think so.
Why would this imperfection be appealing?
Because professional sports recaps are a commodity. You can get data and facts anywhere. What Big Fatty is offering is deeply relatable human experience, which is incredibly rare.
Oh, I see.
Think about how many people sitting at home also tried to stay away for that massive bloated broadcast, only to fall asleep on their couch at 11 o'clock at night.
Probably millions.
Exactly. By confessing to the coma, he completely removes the pretension of being a polished cultural critic. He isn't talking down to the audience from a studio desk. He's experiencing the world exactly as they are, horizontally, fighting fatigue, and ultimately failing to stay awake. It builds profound empathy.
He's not trying to be an authority. He's just trying to be a guy in his living room. And he actually goes a step further in universally grounding this massive event during a conversation he recounts having with a listener named Ryan R. Jones.
This is a fascinating interaction that happens on what he calls the Twitty.
Right, which is his early 2008 parlance for Twitter. And keep in mind, in August 2008, Twitter was still very much in its infancy for the general public.
Oh, yeah. Nobody really knew what it was.
Big Fatty openly admits he doesn't really understand how the platform works yet, but he manages to have this exchange with Ryan. Ryan tweets at him that he simply doesn't understand sports, implying that all the Olympic hype is completely lost on him and the games just aren't for him.
And Big Fatty's response to Ryan is a masterclass in unapologetic reframing. He strips away all the geopolitical context, all the athletic rules, and all the scoring systems.
What does he say?
He replies, "Honey, you understand hot men in a swimming pool because I have been to your house."
It is brilliant. He effortlessly universalizes this incredibly complex global man through his hyper-specific, explicit, unapologetic lens.
He totally does.
He's arguing that you do not need to know the intricate rules of gymnastics or the point system for diving. You simply need to appreciate the aesthetics of the athletes. He tells his audience, "You're a homosexual before you're anything else, so give the Olympics a try."
It is a hilarious line.
Yeah.
But functionally, it's a deeply effective way of granting his specific community permission to take ownership of a mainstream event. He takes a global phenomenon that might feel alienating to a niche community, and he shrinks it down to fit perfectly inside the culture of the fat cave.
He brings the global down to the hyperlocal. And speaking of the hyperlocal, right in the middle of these massive cultural events and the digital deluge of voicemails, the physical, tactile world intrudes on his birthday week in the most bizarre way possible.
We have to talk about the mystery subscription.
Yeah.
This is a real-world anomaly that perfectly disrupts the digital ecosystem he has built.
Big Fatty leaves the fat cave and goes to his physical post office box, hoping to check for any birthday cards or gifts from listeners.
Which is normal enough.
Yeah. But instead, he discovers something entirely inexplicable. Shoved into his P.O. box is a brand new, pristine copy of Woman's Day magazine.
And this wasn't just, like, a stray piece of junk mail dropped in the wrong slot. He looks closely at the mailing label, and he realizes that someone has purchased an anonymous, fully prepaid, year-long subscription to this mid-century-style domestic homemaker magazine.
A whole year.
It is valid all the way through July of 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part? It is addressed directly to Big Fatty.
Seeing his explicit digital podcast moniker printed on the official mailing label of a magazine dedicated to casserole recipes and floral arrangements is such a jarring, hilarious image.
It's so funny.
But what I find most revealing is how he reacts to it. If that happened to me, I would laugh, assume it was a prank, and just throw it in the recycling bin.
Sure, most people would.
Yeah.
But Big Fatty's immediate reflex is entirely governed by his role as a daily content creator. He doesn't discard it. He instantly recognizes the absolute comedic goldmine he has just been handed.
Of course he does.
He gets on the microphone and immediately announces his plans to turn this unsolicited piece of physical mail into a serialized recurring segment for the podcast.
He tells the audience, maybe I'll just have a little segment on What's in Women's Day throughout the year.
That is the genius of the daily pressure cooker format we discussed earlier. When you have to fill 20 minutes every single weekday, a year-long magazine subscription isn't a prank. It's 12 free segments of content.
It's free real estate.
Exactly. Everything that enters his physical orbit, no matter how nonsensical, instantly becomes fuel to keep the audio engine running.
Which perfectly transitions us to the primary fuel source of the week, the voice letters themselves. If you truly want to understand the character and the culture of the BFO universe in 2008, you just have to study the people who felt compelled to pick up a telephone and leave a message.
The sheer variety of characters that flooded the birthday week proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the BFO was never just a monologue. It was a digital neighborhood.
A very weird one.
Yes, a highly populated, incredibly eccentric town where the residents felt immense ownership over the space.
Let's start with how this neighborhood handles the concept of family, because this completely shatters any traditional broadcasting norms. We hear a call from Big Fatty's actual real-life son, Walt.
Now, in a traditional media landscape, a family member calling in for a birthday would be a wholesome, sanitized moment.
Like, happy birthday, Dad, love you.
Right. But Walt calls in to wish his dad a belated birthday. And he actively participates in the ruined, chaotic aesthetic of his father's public persona. He uses the brand's catchphrase, asking, "How else could your birthday be ruined if I was more timely?"
But then he delivers a line that genuinely left me staggered. On recorded line, knowing this audio will be broadcast to thousands of strangers on the internet, a son casually says to his father, "Hope the swing got a workout."
A completely direct, unambiguous reference to a sex swing.
It is mind-blowing. And how does Big Fatty react? He isn't horrified. He doesn't edit it out.
Not at all.
He's absolutely delighted. He plays the audio on the air and responds, "It's always nice when the kids finally do follow through and wish you the happy birthday, and especially when they're also interested in making sure that your sex life is going well, too."
You have to analyze the psychological impact of that interaction on the listener. By broadcasting his own son, making explicit jokes about his sex life, Big Fatty completely normalizes taboo subjects for everyone else.
The bar is set so low.
Well, it establishes a baseline reality where shame does not exist. If the host's own blood relative can casually joke about a sex swing, the listener feels completely liberated to engage with the host on that exact same explicit boundaryless level.
It destroys the fourth wall of polite society.
Yeah.
But the incredible thing about this neighborhood is that it isn't just pure filth and boundary pushing. It's also surprisingly, bizarrely educational.
It really is.
We have an entire faction of listeners who act as historians and educators.
A prime example is a caller known simply as David, that blue jeans guy. David uses his premium voicemail time. He could have just used to sing a quick happy birthday to deliver a highly specific niche historical lecture.
For context, Big Fatty had apparently been musing in a previous episode about how old television shows used to be recorded. So David steps up to the plate.
He really does.
He calls in to explain the intricate history of kinescopes. He details how, in the early years of live television broadcasting, before magnetic videotape was widely used, the only way to preserve a live broadcast was to physically point a motion picture film camera directly at a television monitor and film the screen.
And David doesn't stop there. He bridges the gap between broadcast history and personal nostalgia, throwing in a memory about using physical film strips in school classrooms. Yeah, he uses his voice letter to connect with the host's own generational memories, transforming a birthday wish into a shared historical reflection.
And David isn't the only one taking on an official role. We also hear from Brian from Boston, who Big Fatty officially anoints on the air as the resident historian of the BFO universe.
Brian's call is fascinating because it maps out the physical geography of the early podcasting world. He doesn't just wish Big Fatty a happy birthday. He uses the voicemail to confirm the logistics of an epic upcoming road trip he is taking down the eastern seaboard of the United States.
Brian is literally treating the network of independent podcasters like a tour of historical monuments. He outlines his route. He is heading out to Chicago, down through Missouri, over to Atlanta, and finally ending up in Chucktown, which is the community's nickname for Charleston, South Carolina, where Big Fatty lives.
This kind of cross-country listener pilgrimage highlights the profound parasocial bonds that were forming in 2008.
People were dedicated.
Highly dedicated. Brian mentions emailing other podcasters along his route to ask for autographs. These listeners weren't just downloading MP3 files, they were organizing their physical lives, their vacations, around visiting the creators they listen to every day.
And Big Fatty welcomes this intrusion into his physical life with open arms, promising Brian that he will be greeted with, quote, open pants when he arrives in Chucktown.
So BFO.
Right. The hospitality is just as explicit as the humor. But while Brian is driving across America, the actual reach of this podcast extends far beyond domestic borders. The global footprint in 2008 is genuinely absurd. Which brings us to Kim Beaver.
Oh, Kim Beaver. This call from Kim is one of those moments where the audio reality of the BFO is just stranger than any fiction you could write. Kim is calling in from the Faroe Islands.
And to give you an idea of the sheer isolation we are talking about, the Faroe Islands are a remote, rocky archipelago situated in the North Atlantic Ocean, roughly halfway between Norway and Iceland. It is not exactly a major metropolitan media hub.
And Big Fatty immediately notes that he struggles to understand her accent. He jokingly refers to her as the Mexican, which is his highly politically incorrect, intentionally ignorant character trope that he applies to literally anyone with a foreign accent he can't immediately identify.
But the accent is the least interesting part of this call. Kim informs Big Fatty that she has a pet pilot whale. His name is Gustav.
A whale?
An actual whale. And she claims, with complete sincerity, that she has spent the last several months training this marine mammal to sing happy birthday to him, using massive amounts of raw mackerel as a reward system.
It requires an unbelievable level of parasocial dedication to spend months of your life bribing a whale with fish just to get a 20-second audio clip for an American podcast host.
And then she actually plays the audio on the voicemail, and it is exactly what you would expect, this bizarre, guttural, deep-sea moaning sound echoing over the phone line. She presents this noise as a majestic marine mammal performing a birthday dirge.
Big Fatty's reaction is pure flustered surrealism. He is completely taken aback. He jokingly asks if the sound was actually his own stomach growling.
Classic.
He paints a visual picture for the audience of Kim standing on the icy deck of a whaling vessel, holding a phone out to the ocean. It's an injection of pure, unfiltered absurdity directly into the birthday tribute.
We've gone from sex swings to kinscopes to singing whales. But the neighborhood also has its high rollers, the enablers who actively fuel Big Fatty's ego and his wardrobe.
Oh yes, the enablers.
We hear from two very specific callers who highlight the deeply transactional, consumerist undercurrent of this community. First, we have Tim Cormel.
Tim Cormel is universally recognized within the lore as the patron saint of the BFO. He is a bedrock of the community.
Tim loves the show so much that he has Big Fatty saved in his iPhone contacts simply as the Fats. He calls in to recite an original acrostic poem based on the word happy why.
And what makes it brilliant is that it is perfectly tailored to the show's specific weird lore.
Right, the inside joke.
He recites, H is for the horror that you send our way each day. A is for the apple snacks that we love so much today. P is for the well. P and Y because we love you.
It sounds like a nursery rhyme, but it's built for a very adult, very chaotic audience. And Tim's call seamlessly acts as an introduction for another high-profile community member, Ron Prowho.
And Ron's call is just peak 2008 excess. Ron is calling in live from the middle of the sales floor at a Prada store.
A Prada store.
He is actively, physically shopping for a luxury birthday gift for Big Fatty.
And the gift he is looking for perfectly encapsulates the show. Over the phone, while standing in a high-end designer boutique, he ponders aloud whether Miuccia Prada actually designs luxury leather sex slings.
And when he concludes that she probably doesn't, he pivots. He notes that Prada definitely makes designer leather jock straps, and he enthusiastically offers to buy one and ship it to the Fat Cave.
And Big Fatty immediately, without a second of hesitation, accepts the offer.
You have to remember that in 2008, mechanisms like Patreon or easy monthly podcast subscriptions didn't really exist yet.
Right, it was the Wild West.
Monetization for independent creators was often incredibly direct and highly personal. The listeners didn't just passively consume the audio, they actively supplied the host with physical goods, luxury items, and explicit gifts to keep him happy and engaged.
They were basically funding the reality show they wanted to listen to. But no digital town square, no matter how generous, is complete without a little bit of neighborhood conflict.
Always some drama.
And this week, the drama is served up hot by a listener named Kathy Bacon.
Kathy calls into the voicemail line absolutely fuming. She doesn't lead with a happy birthday. She explicitly announces right at the top that she is about to start talking some SHIT about Big Fatty.
She treats the voicemail like a courtroom, laying out her grievances like a prosecutor. She details her entire weekend of trying to be a good friend. She tweeted at him on Saturday night, asking if he needed a designated driver while he was out celebrating.
And he gave no response.
None. She tweeted at him again on Sunday morning, generously offering to buy him a birthday lunch. Again, no response. Finally, she actually got in her car, drove around his neighborhood, and called his cell phone directly.
And he blatantly ignored the call.
He ghosted her. She is furious at being completely ghosted by a man she's actively trying to support in real life. She ends her voicemail with a sharp, pointed sign-off telling Big Fatty he can suck it.
Is a completely valid accusation.
Mm-hmm.
By all normal social standards, he is being a terrible friend. But how does Big Fatty defend himself against this airtight case?
I can't wait to hear this.
He refuses to apologize, and instead he uses the excuse of profound nocturnal trauma.
This excuse is incredible. I want to challenge this because he expects the audience to just accept it. He gets on the microphone and explains that his entire Sunday and his ability to be a functioning friend was completely derailed because of a phone call he received at 5 a.m.
He was deep in the coma, asleep in the Fat Cave when the phone rang. And he outlines his internal logic for the listener. If his phone rings at 5 in the morning on a weekend, his immediate assumption is that it's a booty call.
Someone looking for early morning intimacy.
Right. But when he squints at the caller ID in the dark, he recognizes the number. It's a friend of his who works the overnight shift. So instantly, the booty call theory is thrown out the window and sheer absolute panic sets in.
Oh, no.
He assumes there's been a catastrophic, life-altering emergency. Why else would someone working a night shift call him at dawn? He answers a phone, his heart pounding out of his chest, ready for the worst news imaginable, only to hear muffled voices and rustling fabric in the background.
His friend working the night shift had accidentally pocket dialed him.
The dreaded 2008 pocket dial. The cell phone was bouncing around in a pocket, and it dialed his number by mistake.
Unbelievable.
Big Fatty claims that the adrenaline spike from this false alarm completely traumatized his sleep cycle. It left him so physically exhausted and emotionally ruined that he couldn't possibly muster the strength to respond to Kathy Bacon's generous offers for lunch.
I want you to step back and look at the absolute symphony of madness we have just detailed in this deep dive into the source material. Think about this chaotic digital town square.
It's a lot.
You have a son making sex jokes, a man explaining film strips, a woman in the Faroe Islands playing guttural whale noises, a guy trying to buy a Prada jock strap, and an angry friend demanding answers for being ghosted. All of these voices are shouting at once.
Yeah.
How does Big Fatty manage to act as the conductor, organizing this pure madness into a consumable daily 20-minute show without losing control of the narrative?
I think the secret is that he doesn't actually try to control the voices at all. He only controls the container they live in. He establishes the rigid zoning laws of this digital town, the strict 20-minute limit, the absolute lack of polite social boundaries, the recurring inside jokes.
Ah, I see.
He pours the concrete foundation, but he relies entirely on the listeners to build the chaotic houses on top of it. He reacts to them, he judges them, he laughs with them, but he never silences them. By broadcasting their weirdness to the world, he validates their existence. But that delicate balance of power relies on the conductor having absolute authority over the reality of the show. So what happens when the architect of the Fat Cave fundamentally misunderstands the basic physics of the digital universe he relies on?
That is a phenomenal question. And it brings us to a highly necessary, mandatory, recurring segment of our deep dive into the archives. because as much as we are celebrating his community building, we must hold him accountable when he gets it wrong.
We absolutely must.
It is time to formally open the archives for a segment we call Ruined Ruination.
In the Ruined Ruination segment, our job is to explicitly correct the factual errors, the misstatements, and the stubborn historical inaccuracies that plague past BFO shows.
Right.
Because while Big Fatty is a master of emotional truth and community engagement, his grasp on objective reality, particularly when it comes to technology and pop culture, is often demonstrably, aggressively wrong.
And today, we must address one of the most epic injustices in the early BFO archives. We have to correct the historical record and vindicate a deeply wronged listener in what we will call the Ryan Starr Jones iTunes saga.
To fully understand the magnitude of this injustice, we have to rewind and set the stage. In the weeks prior to this birthday celebration, a highly dedicated listener named Ryan Starr Jones had submitted a very frustrated, very public complaint.
He was not happy.
Ryan stated that his new BFO episodes were simply not downloading properly into his iTunes software. He was being deprived of his daily show, and he was understandably annoyed.
Now, in 2008, podcast distribution was heavily reliant on Apple's iTunes ecosystem. And Big Fatty's reaction to Ryan's complaint was not empathetic. It was vicious.
Oh, he went.
He immediately went on the offensive. He took to the microphone and verbally attacked Ryan, vehemently claiming that his own podcast RSS feed was pristine, flawless, and perfectly coded.
He completely deflected any possibility of a problem on his end. He entirely blamed Ryan's personal computer hardware, essentially calling him technologically incompetent on a public broadcast.
Which is so mean.
And then, in a display of pure authoritarian hubris, Big Fatty demanded that Ryan perform random acts of kindness out in the real world as a more...
But this specific update contained a critical flaw in how it parsed XML data, which is the code that makes RSS feeds work. Overnight, Apple essentially broke the podcast downloading ecosystem worldwide. Podcasters across the globe were panicking because their audiences were suddenly cut off.
The evidence was empirical, verifiable, and global. Big Fatty was completely, demonstrably wrong to attack his listener. It wasn't Ryan's fault, it was Steve Jobs' fault.
Exactly.
But here's the crux of the injustice, the reason it belongs in Ruined Ruination. Big Fatty never formally apologized to Ryan Sturger.
Never. He eventually acknowledged on air that there was an Apple software glitch, spending time complaining about the tech giant ruining his numbers.
Naturally.
But he completely conveniently glossed over the fact that he had wrongly persecuted and demanded moral penance from a loyal fan. He just absorbed the new reality and moved on as if the attack had never happened.
And this stubbornness, this absolute refusal to concede even an inch of personal fallibility, isn't just limited to massive technological failures. It extends down to the smallest, most pedantic micro details of pop culture history as well.
The archives are absolutely littered with these minor but incredibly telling historical corrections that Big Fatty simply refuses to acknowledge.
Oh, absolutely. Let's look at his pop culture coverage. In the summer of 2008, Pixar released a massive, critically acclaimed animated film about a little trash compacting robot.
WALL-E?
The title of the movie is WALL-E. But Big Fatty absolutely refuses to pronounce it correctly. He insists repeatedly on calling the movie WALL-E, like the old-fashioned name. And despite listeners constantly writing in and correcting him, he stubbornly holds the line, refusing to adapt to reality.
And we see that same stubbornness in his adherence to failed reality TV predictions. During that year's season of American Idol, Big Fatty heavily backed a young contestant named David Archuleta to win the entire competition, heavily favoring him over the rocker David Cook.
And even after David Cook empirically, mathematically won the season by millions of votes, Big Fatty continued to treat David Archuleta as the aesthetic, if not the literal, victor on his podcast.
It's just wild.
He essentially rejected the outcome of the national vote simply because he found Archuleta, quote, cute as he can be.
It even bleeds into his real-life social interactions. He recounts spending an entire weekend at a pool party, repeatedly calling a guest named Will by the name Scott.
For a whole weekend.
And even when Will actually called into the podcast later to gently, politely correct the record and state his actual name, Big Fatty absorbed the correction without an ounce of genuine contrition. He didn't apologize for the rudeness. He just integrated the mistake into the lore of the show, essentially making it Will's problem.
Okay, I have to step in here and ask a really challenging question. When you look at all of this, the refusal to apologize to Ryan, the mispronunciation of WALL-E, the American Idol denial, calling a man by the wrong name for 3 days, Does his absolute refusal to apologize actually alienate his audience? Or, in a strange, twisted psychological way, does his stubbornness actually make the listener trust him more? Does it strengthen his cult of personality because he is so consistently, unapologetically himself?
I strongly believe it's the latter.
Yeah.
It absolutely strengthens his bond with the audience. Think about the alternative. If he were constantly apologizing, constantly checking Wikipedia to ensure his pop culture facts were perfectly straight, constantly issuing retractions, he would completely lose the veneer of being this unbothered, chaotic force of nature.
He would just be a standard newsreader.
Exactly. His refusal to bow to objective reality, whether it is an Apple software patch or the literal title of a Pixar movie, sends a very clear signal to the audience. It tells them that his subjective emotional experience is the only truth that actually matters inside the fat cave. It projects an absolute, unshakable confidence.
Yeah.
And in a digital world full of people desperately trying to be perfectly correct and terrified of being canceled for a mistake, a host who is loudly, confidently, and unapologetically wrong is incredibly magnetic. It creates what we can call the fat cave reality distortion field.
He trains the audience to accept his reality, flaws, and all. But it's important to remember that this reality distortion field doesn't exist in a total vacuum.
Right, he's not alone out there.
Big Fatty isn't broadcasting into an empty void. His show is deeply connected to a broader, highly interdependent ecosystem, which brings us to the survival mechanics of early podcasting.
We have to look at the network synergy. The landscape of independent podcasting in 2008 was a harsh, unforgiving place.
It really was.
You couldn't rely on massive corporate marketing budgets to buy billboard space. You couldn't rely on sophisticated social media algorithms to magically push your content onto people's screens. To survive, you had to build your own manual distribution mechanisms.
And for Big Fatty, that survival mechanism was the RNL Podcasting Network. This was a tight-knit collective of independent shows that he affectionately and very accurately refers to as the incestuous web.
Incestuous web is a brilliant, self-aware term for it, because these podcasters survived by building a manual algorithm of cross-promotion. They constantly guest-starred on each other's shows. They shared deeply embedded inside jokes that bled from one podcast feed to the next, and they wove their actual personal lives into an interconnected tapestry of lore.
To give you some context on how deep this went, earlier we mentioned Brian from Boston driving across the country to visit podcasters.
Yeah, his epic road trip.
He specifically mentioned events and networks like the PNS Explosion, which were massive, early, real-world meetups where all these podcasters and fans would converge, usually in a city like Chicago. You had interconnected hubs like the QCast Connection, which served as a pioneering directory for queer podcasters to find each other and share audiences.
It was a whole community.
You had massive reigning figures in this web, like Archer and Superb, who hosted highly influential shows that set the tone for the entire community. It wasn't just a list of shows. It was a living, breathing social club.
And we see a prime mechanical example of this cross-promotion in action during the birthday week. Big Fatty dedicates a significant chunk of his precious 20-minute airtime to heavily promoting a contest being run by his friend and fellow network host, Larry Cly.
Larry hosts a show on the network called LK Today, and Larry is running what he calls a Hoot Nanny contest. Now, the mechanics of this contest are fascinating because they require immense effort from the listener.
They really do.
To enter, the listener has to physically dial a very specific voice letter number 206-426-6914 and leave an audio guess.
But the crucial detail is what they are actually guessing. They aren't guessing a trivia question about Larry's show. Larry is asking his audience to guess the specific music that Big Fatty has recently loaded onto his brand new piece of Apple hardware.
Hardware that Big Fatty hilariously dubs his iPod Inappropriate Touch.
It is synergy at its absolute finest. You have one podcaster running a contest about the personal life of another podcaster. And Big Fatty takes it a step further. He promises his audience that if they call Larry's number and leave a guess, he will literally take those voice messages, bring them back over to the BFO feed, and play them on his own show later in the week.
That is dedication to cross-promotion.
He promises to deliver either a bell sound effect for a correct guess or a buzzer for a wrong one. He actively sells this convoluted process to the audience as getting two podcasts for the price of one.
When I look at this cross-promotion strategy, I compare it to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but built entirely for early 2008 digital audio. Think about the barrier to entry here.
It's steep.
To truly understand the storyline of one single show, to get the inside jokes, to understand why people are calling a specific phone number about an iPod inappropriate touch. The listener is practically forced to consume the entire network. If you only listen to BFO, you're only getting half the movie. You are compelled to go download LKNend. Today, you have to understand the references to Archer and Superb. You have to track the movements of the entire web. It brilliantly traps the listener in a walled garden of interconnected content.
And it is highly, highly effective for audience retention. But you also have to acknowledge the toll it takes on the creator. Managing that much interconnected lore, dealing with the daily technical glitches of 2008 software, and wrangling an audience that includes angry friends, historical lecturers, and singing whales, it generates an immense amount of chaotic, unpredictable energy.
And a conductor dealing with that much chaos needs a scapegoat. Big Fatty needs a grand unifying theory to explain why the technology fails, why the listeners act so bizarrely, and why the entire week feels so wonderfully unhinged.
And rather than take the blame himself, he finds the perfect, completely unassailable culprit, Celestial Mechanics.
Yes, the full moon. He notes on the show that there is an impending full moon approaching over the weekend, and he uses this astronomical event to tie a neat bow around all the insanity.
That's perfect.
He warns the listener with absolute deadpan sincerity to look out because the crazies will be out. He specifically theorizes that the lunar influence, when combined with the global fever of the Olympics, is going to cause pure mayhem in the digital neighborhood.
It is the ultimate masterstroke deflection of responsibility. It wasn't my fault I mispronounced the name of a movie. It wasn't my fault the Apple RSS feed broke. It wasn't my fault that a woman in the Faroe Islands called me with a whale. It was the gravitational pull of the moon.
Naturally.
It adds a brilliant layer of pseudo-mysticism to his highly domestic, highly technological complaints.
It is absolute perfection. So when we step back and look at the totality of this week, what does it all mean? We have spent the last hour unpacking a week where a man fell asleep during the climax of the Olympics, received a physical subscription to Woman's Day magazine, got a birthday serenade from a pilot whale, got yelled at for ignoring a pocket dial, aggressively refused to apologize for a global Apple software glitch, and ultimately blamed the entire chaotic mess on the moon.
What it means is that we are witnessing a masterclass in community building. But it's community building achieved not through perfection, but through vulnerability and sheer stubborn willpower.
Which leaves us with a final, lingering, provocative thought for you to explore on your own long after this audio ends. Think about today's modern digital landscape. We live in a world that is intensely filtered and highly curated. Every Instagram post is color corrected. Every TikTok video is tightly scripted to maximize algorithmic perfection. In a world desperate to project flawlessness, is the ultimate shortcut to genuine, lasting human connection simply having the courage to publicly, unapologetically share your own messy, unfiltered ruin?
Does presenting a pristine, untouchable image actually push people away? While admitting that you fell into a coma at 9 o'clock at night and that your friends accidentally pocket dial you at 5 in the morning draws them inexorably closer, is a fascinating question of what we actually value in the media we choose to let into our lives.
It really is. The imperfection isn't a flaw, it's the entire point. Thank you for taking this massive journey into the archives with us today. Just as a reminder before we go, my name is King.
And my name is Gail.
And we have one final crucial reminder for you. Please make sure to tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, the early years as we continue to unpack the glorious chaos of the BFO universe. We will see you then.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.